It's Monday, April 3rd, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Lubbock, Texas. Well, good evening, and we'll have a very short introduction for this podcast because it actually is rather lengthy. This was a keynote presentation that I shared today in Fort Worth, Texas at the Region 11 Education Service Center with approximately 170 teachers, administrators, librarians, even had a school superintendent there, and we were talking about the digital face of 21st century curriculum. But the more appropriate title for this, and the theme that I really tried to weave throughout it, was Opening the Door, or Open the Door, Conversations, Complexity, and Messy Assessment. And really, I think, is a culmination of a lot of thinking that I've been doing over the past series of months and even years about the education that we need to be offering our students, the education our students deserve, and the education which really they must have to be successful and thrive in the 21st century. If you have any comments or questions about this podcast or feedback, I would certainly welcome those on the podcast post, which is on my blog at www.speedofcreativity.org, or you can always visit my personal homepage at www.wesfryer.com and just click the contact link to either send me an email or connect to a web form where you can submit feedback that'll come directly to me. I would like to just real briefly say a word of thanks to so many of you who, through your blog posts, your comments on my blog, your messages that you're writing in the blogosphere, have really shaped my own thinking about education in a lot of ways in the past months, and specifically Miguel Gulen, who was co-keynoting with me today in Fort Worth, and also others like Darren Kerpatwa, Ewan McIntosh, who have participated in our international Skype cast conversations about education, Paul Clark, who was in Orlando with me a couple weeks ago and really got me turned on to Google Earth, and just many others that I really are too many to mention, but I just appreciate the conversation that we are engaged in and look forward to learning even more as we continue to explore the possibilities for creative education in the 21st century.
Great. Thank you, Norma. It is a real honor and privilege to be able to be with you today. And I must say that there's not a more exciting time, there's not been a more exciting time to be alive than today in 2006. However, some people might also add to that there's never been a more disruptive or a scarier or a more uncertain time to live than in 2006. And today we're going to talk about the face of 21st century digital curriculum, but I don't just want to describe that to you. I also want to talk to you and talk with you about how we can employ that and leverage that to really engage kids and, as Randy talked about, prepare them for their future. Randy mentioned, and I'm just totally honored to follow Alan November and Willard Daggett, that they had talked about whether or not we are passive consumers or we are active creators. And I would start today by sharing that is a choice. In schools, we have a lot of experience with traditional education, and traditional education is a consumption-based enterprise. And we're doing that today. And so I don't think it's automatic that all of a sudden, woohoo, we're all on MySpace creating content. Maybe we are. Have you surveyed your students? Do you know how many are? That's actually the focus of my dissertation that I'm working on right now. We are set back 15 minutes, and so I think your program says that we're going to finish up for a break at 10:15. We're moving everything back 15 minutes, so we'll wrap up by 10:30. But what I'm going to talk about today, and again, I challenge you to talk about too, are three ideas. The ideas of education as conversation, the need for complexity in education, that might go right with things you've heard Daggett and others talk about with rigor and relevance, relationships, results, some people add results to be in there, and then this idea of messy assessment. How many of you are administrators on a campus? Do we have some campus administrators? We have some. How many of you are instructional technology coaches, facilitators, support folks? Do we have any librarians today in the audience? We do. Do we have any classroom teachers in the audience today? All right. Do we have any superintendents, assistant superintendents? We do. Do we have someone else? We do. We've got other people that didn't fit one of those categories. That's good. Because what we're talking about today really, I think, has broad applicability. Whether you are teaching in the elementary school, as I did for 6 years, whether you are at the university level, whether you are at high school, wherever you are, you want to engage students and you want to prepare them for the future which they'll face. So here's my theme today, and it's open the door. A door is a powerful metaphor. We talk about closing the gaps in Texas. You know what closing the gaps is really about in terms of high school dropout rates? It's about trying to get Texas up to the state, to the national average. Okay, but we need to get even higher than that. Our challenge today is to open the door to conversations, to complexity, and to messy assessment, to provide the classroom environment and the learning environment that our kids deserve and need. So I went on to Flickr to look for some pictures of some doors, and I didn't really decide which one fit, so I got three. I don't know if you've heard of the Creative Commons. I'll be talking about that in my session. One of the best places to find images that you have copyright permission to reuse and remix is the Creative Commons. And Flickr has a website that is just set up for Creative Commons shared images. So I went right there to the Creative Commons Flickr image, went to the ones that are licensed for attribution only, so you can see the web address. By the way, this entire presentation will be available as a podcast. If you'd like to share this with other people at a later time, that just recorded audio that other people can get. But anyway, I thought this was a nice picture of a door. It's a modern door. It's a revolving door. It's a lot of metal there. It's glass. It looks fancy. So we might think of the door that we want to open today being the technological door, okay, the high-tech door. And to an extent, we're talking about that because for each one of those points today, I'm going to share an example and a tool that I think really embodies that idea, the idea of conversation, the idea of complexity, and the idea of messy assessment. But I like this door also because this is the door that's letting in the light. You can see this picture is taken from a dark place. I think a case can be made that in education, we have a lot of folks in the darkness. We have a lot of people struggling to help kids, struggling to help improve expectations and improve student performance. But if you have heard of the cave of Plato, I think a case can be made, and this comes from Miguel Doolin, my co-keynote speaker today. There's this idea of people being inside the cave and not seeing the three-dimensional color reality that is out there in the world. Looking at the wall of the cave and seeing the shadows that are in two dimensions and thinking, that's reality. So I like this door. And I also like this door. This is from Portugal. I don't know exactly where it is. I'm going to talk about Google Earth and geotagging and just this amazing world that's exploding around us with technology, and especially the linkages between information, data, and geography. I was a geographer, and I am a geographer, a student of geography as an undergraduate, and I love that. And I like this door because it's an old door. Education is an old and very austere and distinguished and almost holy. It is a holy profession. We're in a mission field. Okay? We are called to take the most precious resources that parents could give us, their children, and they entrust them to us. And so the challenge today is to open the door. What does it mean to open the door? Well, you've heard a lot of terms, and how many of you have heard about or read The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman? Okay, this is the book, The Making the Circuit Now. Lots of speakers are talking about it. We listened to it on tape or on actually iPod this summer. Yes, my whole family of five was subjected to Thomas Friedman, The World is Flat. I don't think my kids got a lot out of it. My wife did. But we've heard these things like outsourcing, okay, flatteners. Google's flattened the earth. You want to do some kind of project development today? You want to learn something today? Where can you go? You can go to Google. We've heard a message. We need to catch up. We're behind. Not graduating engineers and scientists at the rate of India and China. Have you done that population comparison, by the way? Do you know how many people are in China and India? It's kind of an interesting thing to note in that conversation. Science and math, STEM. It's all about science, technology, math. Gosh, we got to catch up. What do? We got to work harder. India and China are going to take our jobs. They're going to eat our lunch. Now, I am not, like you may have seen some speakers do, going to either buy or sell a message of fear today. Because that is a big message. If you read The World is Flat, one of the things I think you walk away from is this idea of, do I need to be scared? And if you go to educational technology conferences today, I was at the Florida Educational Technology Conference 2 weeks ago in Orlando. The message of fear sells in America today at technology conferences. One of the keynote speakers, third slide, 9/11. Now, if I just show you 9/11, that picture, there's all kinds of baggage. I mean, a picture communicates, thousands of words, millions of words, feelings, emotions. This is not my message today. My message is not a message of fear. Because I'm going to conclude with this idea. I don't have a slide for it now. But I have an abiding faith in teachers. And whether you're an administrator or you're an instructional technologist, you're an educator. We are a smart, smart people. Think about it. Have you seen the IMAX film Tom Hanks helped put together called Walking on the Moon? It's about the Apollo space missions. I was at the Cosmosphere in Hutchinson, Kansas, 3 weeks ago on spring break. An amazing film. I mean, to date myself, okay, we landed on the moon about a year before I was born. I was born in August of 1970. We landed on the moon in July of 69, right? It is so amazing to me to think that we landed on the moon with the technology and the computing power that's in a $2 calculator that I can get from Walmart. I mean, it's so amazing that when I look at those images, I do think to myself, did we really do that as a nation? But we did. Phenomenal. Now, I forgot my DVD, and, you know, time-wise, maybe it's okay. But if I was going to show you a video clip today, how many of you have seen Apollo 13? The clip when they have to make the square filter go into the round hole. It really happened, okay? My 8-year-old son watching this said, Dad, is that real? Son, these are actors, but yes. This is why if you want to be a scientist and if you want to be an engineer, you have got to be creative. You have got to be able to think outside the box. You cannot just fill in someone else's blanks on a worksheet. You cannot just solve the problem as it's constructed on the multiple choice test. Because the problems you will solve are ones that have not even been thought of before, with tools that have not even been invented. So, fear is not what we're talking about today. We are going to talk about a different frame. I'm going to try to frame this conversation, or this discussion today, first off with a story. And then I'm going to ask you all to talk to each other. But I want to tell you a quick story about Mrs. Green. Mrs. Green was my 7th grade math teacher. I don't know what happened to Mrs. Green. I've actually not told this story before. But one of the things I remember from 7th grade math, two things. Number one, we always started with a story problem. Okay? Anybody have bad experiences with story problems? Well, one of the things Mrs. Green did that was different, and I don't think I ever had another math teacher like this, was she invited us to write our own story problems. So on the overhead projector, the technology of the day. Anybody still using overhead projectors? When I was teaching 4th grade, I would always come home with all this ink all over my hand, and it sometimes never really seemed to go away. It was just always this mix of red and green and black. But my story problems were up on the board. I remember that. I lived in Kansas, but I really thought mountain climbing would be a cool thing to do. So I wrote story problems about climbing mountains. Anyway, that was a very challenging thing and an engaging thing because that, when you write the problem, when you ask the question, you are at a different level cognitively than when you're just answering the question. So one of the things we want to do, like Mrs. Green, probably in 1982, is we want to open up what's really not a new door. It's an old door. It's called a door of authentic assessment and engaged learning, meeting learners where they are, differentiating the curriculum. Doesn't take technology to do that, but it does take this idea of a conversation and engaging someone in a conversation. You know what we did with technology in 1982? Does this ring a bell for anyone? Now, this actually wasn't a 1982 Commodore computer because we didn't have disk drives. We had cassette tapes. Okay? I remember in 7th grade math learning a little bit about programming in BASIC with these little programs you wrote. 10. Print was ?, quote, this is so cool, end quote. Next line, 20, go to 10, run. Wow, look how cool that is. It makes that go all the way down the board. Now, some of you are relating to this, some of you are going, what are you talking about, Wes? I mean, I took a cassette tape to school to save my programs on. That's what we did at that time with technology, okay? But Mrs. Green was teaching us 7th grade math, and so she was challenging us to create and to go places with technology. And I really do believe that part of my early education with technology that involved some programming, no, I don't code in Perl, PHP, MySQL, no thanks. I have a free WordPress blog, and I can change some code on the side, so I have a little sidebar icon that goes to Global Voices that I'll show you today, that's Harvard's project with millions of people all over the world going to hear what is the world saying in this country or that country about this issue. But here was a foundation for me, okay? And this is where I'm going with this. This is my cluster map from yesterday. Cluster map is a free service. You can put it on any web page you want. Put it on your district homepage, put it on your classroom homepage, put it on your blog, put it wherever you want. And it automatically grabs the IP address of whoever is pulling up the page and maps it to the globe. Let's zoom in a little bit. All the dots you see on this map are people around the world who have pulled up my blog, Moving at the Speed of Creativity. Who is reading my blog in Ecuador? In the middle of Colombia? On the Chilean-Argentine border? In Argentina? In what looks like Buenos Aires? I mean, who is... Look at the Caribbean. Right side of Hispaniola, that's the Dominican Republic. I don't know what that is south of Cuba. East of that's Puerto Rico. I have no clue what that is in the Antilles. Somebody in Nicaragua or El Salvador? Look at in Mexico. All over the United States, people in Canada. Let's switch to Africa and Asia. Look at the Arabian Peninsula. Somebody in the middle of Arabia, I don't know what they're reading, because that particular person hasn't emailed me, but somebody in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula has pulled up Wes Fryer's blog, who's just a guy in Lubbock, Texas, who's a teacher, and is reading some of the things he's saying. Look at Europe. Look at Africa. Look at the base of Africa. Is that Cape Town? Look at Japan. Look across at Korea. I don't think that's North Korea. I heard that Kim Il-sung is the only person on the internet in North Korea. I don't know if that's true or not. Look at China. Seriously, I think in our lifetimes, we're going to see a transformation in China. They are not going to be able to keep the lid on this. If you listen to NPR, to some of the things that they're talking about with Chinese bloggers, I mean, what just happened here in our country with MySpace and the protests over immigration? That's old news in China, because instant messaging and social networking and all these things are phenomenal tools of social mobilization, which the central government does not have complete control over. So, this blows me away. From the Commodore 64 to a global conversation. Miguel told me last night, someone from Morocco just emailed him. about something that he had on his blog. That would not have happened without technology, folks. We have two different levels of technology use broadly. We have the accommodation level, where we're doing stuff, but we're using technology. Could I talk about this without technology? Sure, I could. Okay, I think I'm enhancing it a little bit. I'm recording this, I'm making it available to other people. But still, PowerPoint is typically an accommodation level use of technology, a level one. I've heard Alan November call the second level information, doing things impossible to do without the technology. And so my challenge to you today is to use the technology to take it up a notch, to quote Emerald. Okay? Let's take it up a notch and do those things we could not do, engage in those conversations we could not engage in without the technology. We don't have to use technology to do that, to open that door. But kids get pretty excited about conversations. And if there's one thing I've heard students in our one-to-one laptop initiatives across the state with the Texas Immersion Pilot Project say, it's that, what do you think they want to do when they have their computer at home, if they're allowed to take it home? What do you think they want to do? They want to be social. Surprise! And we can do that safely and in an environment where we are not just talking about safety, but we're talking about digital citizenship, we're talking about civil discourse, we're talking about respect. We need to do that. We have an obligation to do that. Okay, so that's my story. We are literally, folks, minutes away from kids having handheld Cray computers in their hands, and every one of the kids in your building has one. Okay? Because it's going to be a cell phone. At the last Japanese electronics show, they had a cell phone with an 8-gigabyte hard drive. Okay? Full motion video. This is, by the way, the best cell phone or a digital camera I've ever had. Why? It's always with me. And I can immediately take your picture and web post that to Flickr through an email address. Incredible. That can be geotagged to our location, and anybody who's interested in Fort Worth, Texas could see that picture a matter of minutes, if not seconds, after it's taken. That's disruptive. That's potentially scary, but it's also potentially very powerful. So, are the kids ready for this? Absolutely. I mean, they were ready yesterday. Okay? They were ready last year. Are you ready for it? Are your teachers ready for it? Probably not. And so one of the reasons we need to be having this conversation and using these tools and learning together is because it is just going to keep getting faster and more powerful, and we need to leverage these tools to engage kids. Mark Prinsky talks about engage me or enrage me. What's the dropout rate in your district, in your high school? How many of the kids drop out because they are bored? They are not engaged. It's a crime, people. It is a crime. And we have got to get kids excited about education and passionate about this world that we live in, because there are things worth fighting for. There are things worth fighting, stands worth taking. And I don't know that I really get that idea in a passive, transmission-based educational model. I can get that sense when I'm asked to engage in a conversation. So that's what we're going to do right now, and I'm going to give you about 5 minutes. And here's your assignment. We're going to do a little story circle activity. You know, it's hard to have a conversation if only one person's talking. Notice that. Happens in school a lot. It happens here. I mean, you came to sit and get. We're going to do that. But I want you to also talk to somebody beside you, because I would bet that what you're about to talk about with the person beside you will be one of your takeaways from today. I'm doing this for, you know, an important reason. Because we learn more through our experiences and our conversation than we do when we just hear somebody talk. So here's your assignment. I want you to turn to someone near you, two or three people maybe, and I want you to, with that person, define the most important things about a high-quality educational environment. And I want you to get personal. I don't want you to just have on your administrator hat or your I'm the accountability director for the district hat. I want you to have your mommy hat on. I want you to have your grandparent hat on. If we're talking about your children and where you want your kids to be in school, with a few words, define what makes that high quality. Why would that particular... You have a choice. Here's four classrooms you can go to. Why do you choose to be in Mrs. Green's class? Why do you not choose to be in Mr. Fire's class or whoever it might be? Okay? You got a few minutes. Go. Man, that's a large group to get quiet. You know that? Anybody want to share? What was one of the qualities that you shared or that somebody else shared?
Relationships.
Relationships? You want to elaborate a little bit?
Well, I think it's important at all levels, and for the teacher and the student to have a relationship, one of respect. Teacher needs to be knowledgeable in their content area, but they've got to show a willingness to help, to support, to be there, to understand, to try to engage.
Okay, good. Relationships. What else? Yes, sir.
Teachers who are willing to take risks and get out of their comfort zone to be able to learn and apply more of the technology that's available.
Because technology is risky, but hey, you know what? Is teaching risky? You never know what you're going to get. Yet, a lot of times we'll teach in a way we can embrace risk or not embrace risk to different degrees. And the classrooms, I think, where kids tend to want to be are the ones where that teacher is willing to take a risk, willing to make a mistake, willing to admit they're wrong, but go on and learn. Risk-taking is huge. In fact, I bet that's one of the most important factors in predicting whether teachers in your school district continue to use technology, is how comfortable are they with risk. Okay, so, good. Anybody in this group? Anybody? I know you were talking, but you don't have to share.
I said engagement with structure. That I like to walk in a teacher's room. I like my child to go into a teacher's room that they all know what to do, but they're all doing different things. And there is a calmness to the room, but yet lots and lots of activity.
And that sounds a lot differently than this room sounds right now.
Right.
And you also just said differentiate the curriculum. That's what I heard you say. Because the curriculum should not be the same for every learner. We know that when we do IEPs. Sometimes we forget that when we think about the whole class. So, okay? Anybody from over here want to share? Yes, ma'am. Bloom's taxonomy, yes.
And also treat each child as they come to us in an IEP.
Did you hear that? Thinking about Bloom's taxonomy and thinking about challenging kids to go to that higher level of synthesis and analysis and reflective thinking and treating every child as if they come to us with an IEP. Because you know what? Whether it's written down or not, we all have one. We all learn differently. Anybody else want to share something that came out? Did anybody talk about testing? The only time I'm going to talk about this today. The reason for this activity. If we talk to each other about this issue, what defines quality? Do we have to do tests? Yes. Do we want kids to succeed on tests? Yes. But is that what I'm looking for as I am going to be soon shopping for a new place to live with my family and a new school to go to? Absolutely not. I'll tell you, I'm actually looking for a school that's really into the arts, it's really into music, it's really into kids. It's really into kids getting excited about learning, and so excited about learning that they sometimes don't even want to leave school. Let's talk about this thing called digital curriculum. What does it mean? Were any of you at Region 10 at Richardson in February with me when we talked about curriculum for the 21st century? A couple people, they're not admitting it, that's okay. I recognize a few folks. Well, I used the Robert Frost poem, and I'm going to read the whole thing to you today. 1915, this is an old door, this isn't a new door, but we're living in a new day. We have two paths, I think, when it comes to digital curriculum, and actually when it comes to education overall. And so let's talk about what's behind door number one and door number two, but let's first listen to what Robert Frost wrote. I'm getting this right, 1915. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both. And be one traveler, long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could, to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay, and leaves no step had trodden black, oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how the way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. For each one of these options, we've got digital curriculum. We can employ digital curriculum to serve two very different pedagogical or educational goals and paradigms. For each one of these I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to talk about a digital curriculum example. I'm going to give you an administrator challenge to take back to your school district. And the overall theme is to open the door. But what door are you opening? I hope that's door number two. Door number one is transmission-based education. And it is a model we are all very familiar with because we are steeped in it. If you want to see this in its possibly purest form, go to many alternative school settings where you have all the kids sitting quietly at a computer, reading their content off of the web or off of the CD, taking their tests, okay, computer-based examinations, CBE, getting their credit, getting their GED, or it may be a full high school diploma. Oftentimes you see it there. What does door number one lack if we talk about digital curriculum that is either web-based or CD-based or whatever? What does it tend to lack? Interaction, collaboration, creativity, multimodal communication. If I am being asked primarily to respond to a multiple choice set of questions on a computer, I do not need to know anything about blogs. I do not need to know anything about podcasting. I do not need to know much about oral presentation. I don't need to know much about relating to other people and working with others in a group. I don't, because that's not what's being valued in that environment. I don't need to know much about synthesis, about higher order thinking. Maybe some of the questions are going to challenge me to do that, possibly, but in general, most of that stuff is at a low level of Bloom's taxonomy. There might not be much in the way of higher order thinking behind door number one. And there is definitely not much ill-structured problem solving. And I'm going to elaborate on this more today. Because in schools, as Dr. David Jonathan of the Center for Problems of the Study of Problem Solving at the University of Missouri talks about, we do well-structured problem solving. Okay, remember the problems about trains leaving the station? We'll talk about those. You don't have much ill-structured problem solving. We'll elaborate on that more. So, we have many educational fantasies behind door number one, appropriate ones that we can talk about in this forum. And here's the biggest, I think. If we were to do a Venn diagram of what 21st century literacy skills are and what skills are reinforced in a time-pressured, fear-laden, high-stakes testing environment, I do not think there is a large degree, or maybe in some context, any overlap between those skills. But I'm not going to talk a lot about that. That's not my frame today. And I want you to tell you, I'm not living in a vacuum. Okay? We are here in Texas. Two of my three children are in school. We have an assessment at our school, just like they do at yours. I taught, you know, in the mid to late 90s and early in 2000, 2001 in the schools, and then joined our College of Education. I'm aware of the environment that we live in. Okay, I'm not coming from Mars with this. I am coming to you with a lot of hats, and one hat is someone who's very passionate about wanting the schools that my children attend and that your children attend to be the schools they deserve and the schools they need. So let's talk about Bloom's taxonomy. That's already come up. Go to Google, put in Bloom's taxonomy, click images, you get a bunch of results. Here's one of them from the United Kingdom, okay? We have lower order, which is generally considered the knowledge and comprehension level. We have higher order, the application, analysis, synthesis, and evaluation levels of thinking. Now this is very telling. This comes to us, you look at the website, from a university. You can identify what it is before the .edu. And, you know, this, we're not going to credit this university with having this perspective. This is one professor who's a biology professor's slide on Bloom's taxonomy. But if you can see on the right, what does he have written beside the knowledge and comprehension level? That's what we do in high school. You know, analysis and application, that's what we do as undergraduates. That's what we do in graduate school is evaluation and synthesis. I think that's bunk, okay? Now, as a description of reality, perhaps it's accurate, but as a prescriptive idea, no, absolutely not. We absolutely cannot say we're just here to learn facts and regurgitate information in high school and you'll have to wait for college. Because guess what? Half your kids, at least, are probably not going to get there in a lot of settings. And they need to learn how to problem solve at a very high level of complexity. The last thing I want to clear up here, and then we're going to look at a very, very cool website called Global Voices, is clean versus messy assessment. Okay? We're going to talk about that and elaborate that. On that, in this idea of door number two. We know a lot about clean assessment. We need to be doing more messy assessment. So, what is door number two? Well, a little acronym for you. CCMA. Door number two is conversation, complexity, and messy assessment. And these are my points today. You just engaged in a conversation with someone beside you, talking about what defined a high-quality educational environment. If we think about what changes us, I think we would probably agree that conversation, of all the choices that we could have, has a high likelihood of possibly changing us. It may not change us. So this is what we're going to talk about. Door number two, conversation. Why are you here? Any volunteers? Anybody here because they wanted to be? Some? Okay. I see a few timid hands. They're looking around. Okay. Oftentimes we're here because we have to be here, right? Why are the kids there in your room? Well, they have to be there. Dr. Jonathan, when he spoke to us at Texas Tech about a month and a half ago, suggested that if we really wanted to reform education big time in our country, let's do away with mandatory public schooling. And let's make the schools have to draw their kids to their doors, into their classrooms. Okay. I think we're here so we walk away changed. Miguel and I were talking about this last night, and he was reminding me that parents may, in some cases, not be that idealistic. They may just want their kids to succeed, but not really know what... I mean, you got 100 on your spelling test, honey. That's great. Okay, you got a straight A report card. That's great. You know, you got good grades, so, you know. But I think, idealistically, the reason I am here, and the reason I am in school, and I'm teaching... is so that hopefully we walk away changed. Because of this interaction we had together, we think about the world differently. So, what changes students? And I'm doing the Atlas complex here. I'm rhetorically posing my own question, holding the weight of the world on my shoulders, and I'll answer my own question. But that's what we do in these kind of settings, right? Well, I think experiences change students, right? That's why field trips are so important. Were any of you involved in the video conference last week from the Texas Tech International Cultural Center with the Holocaust survivor, Eva Hance, who survived Dachau at age 11 and lived there for 7.5 months, and the camp liberator who liberated Mauthausen? Powerful. I bet your kids will remember her story. I bet they will remember Mark's story. Mark Geislin is his name. The last time they were doing that live was archived and saved. But when kids go on a field trip, they tend to remember that. That's an experience. Okay? We kid ourselves sometimes and we think, hey, read this chapter. That's an experience. Probably not. Okay? Interactions change people, change kids. If we were to, this would be a great activity for us to do. If we were to spend all day today doing digital storytelling, and I was to ask each of you to think of a transformative time in your own educational history, when you were a student, when you were a teacher, and I want you to start writing and try to tell a short story about that, you know, there's going to be interactions that are happening in that situation. It's not just, oh, I took that test and, you know, I got that A. You know, I was very fortunate when I grew up in Manhattan, Kansas, to have a physics teacher that was all about hands-on learning. I was not a physics major. I was a fuzzy political science geography person in college, but I remember labs that we did that were about the Newtonian laws and the metal balls going down the tracks and the mirrors that we reflected things and the Bunsen burners we lit. I remember that stuff. It's a lot of classes that if I really think hard, gosh, what did I remember? Interactions teach us, and conversation teaches us. Okay? So, here's the question. How many experiences, interactions, and conversations are we intentionally trying to encourage students to have appropriately in school? That's our challenge. The key is getting teachers to ask questions that are worth asking and worth answering. And let me tell you, if everyone in your class is writing a how-to about making a hamburger, that's really not a question that's worth spending a lot of time on. We need to engage kids with questions that are worth asking and they're worth answering. Okay, do they need to know how to write a how-to? Of course. You know, should everyone be able to write a how-to about making a hamburger? Of course. But getting kids motivated, as a fourth grade writing teacher, I believed and know, getting them motivated and excited to write was over half the battle. Here is your administrator challenge, AC number one. Okay? Go back to your school building and listen in the classrooms that you go into. I want you to listen to the questions that are being asked. Number one, are all the questions being asked by the teacher? Or are questions being asked by the students? Because it is just as important or even more important that students are asking questions and answering questions than just the teacher. And I want you to think about it with the lens of Bloom's, okay? I started to wear glasses maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I look through the world with this set of lenses, and the world looks differently because I do. Usually it looks a little clearer if I've cleaned them. Think about Bloom's taxonomy and higher order questions. Are your teachers, are the students around you asking questions that are just at that knowledge and comprehension level, or are they asking questions that go beyond? And then think about how to encourage those kind of questions. We have got to engage students in conversations. They do it all the time. Okay, a lot of times we feel like we're just keeping the lid on it. But we want to leverage that social desire that they have to interact, to communicate, to write, to engage with text, right? Text isn't just written with a pencil on a page. There's a lot of text around us. And so I'm going to talk right now about blogs and blogging, and I'm going to show you a specific example. I don't want anybody to get bogged down, stopped by vocabulary. A blog, some people say, is a diary on the internet. Yes, some people keep a diary on the internet. But a blog is a tool. Okay? Think about a carpenter. Okay? Do you have carpenters that come in and say, you know, I'm kind of just a hammer carpenter. I really don't do the drill thing, you know. I just like this hammer. This is what I use, so I'm a hammer carpenter. As teachers, we're always, I think, should be looking for tools that will help us do our job effectively. And blogs are a tool that let you write the web. You heard Randy at the beginning talk about us not just being consumers of content, but creators of content. Think of a blog as your pencil for the internet. Your students right now that have accounts on MySpace or Zanga or Bebo or any of these social networking sites, they are writing the web. Not just with text, with a lot of things, with images, with music. You know. Do they need our help, by the way? Not to figure it out, but to do it appropriately? To do it safely? You better believe they do. Don't have the idea that in this technology-infused world, suddenly the role of the teacher is inconsequential. It's as important as it ever has been. I won't say it's more important than it ever has been, because I think it's always been important. It's an old door. It's called the door of authentic teaching. So, MySpace, it was on the radio when Miguel and I drove up to this service center this morning of a student apologizing because he had sent through MySpace messages to five of his classmates about a protest or a walkout, and it just took off. And he apologized to the school board, and he got back in class. Okay? Folks, these tools are not going away. Why are kids writing the internet? Because it's incredibly engaging to be involved in a global conversation about stuff you care about. And we need to be leveraging these tools in school, not just banning them. Randy mentioned Alan November's blog tool. Here's another one. Go to Google. Put in the word Blogmeister. This is David Warlick's free tool for teachers that enables them to have safe blogs. In fact, I just heard about a Garland teacher that had to go all the way to her school board, explain Blogmeister, how does it work? Okay, you register as a teacher, you set up student accounts, you write and publish articles, and then students write and edit their articles. They submit it to the teacher for review within Blogmeister, which is a free tool, web-based, whatever you use, whatever kind of computer, just using your web browser. The teacher reviews it and then approves it. Comments come in, the teacher approves it. So we don't have to be worried that, as they will, if that is totally open and free, someone's going to say something inappropriate. Well, maybe they are. But the point is, it doesn't go on the classroom blog immediately. Gatekeeper. Opening the door. You stand at the door as the teacher here in the classroom blogging situation. And you can do it very safely and very powerfully. And I can tell you stories about that, but we'll let Miguel and others possibly tell more stories. I want to take you to this website. Have you heard of Global Voices? Harvard Project. Anybody heard of it? GlobalVoicesOnline.org. Reporters around the world are now increasingly going to Global Voices when they write news articles. Why? Well, let me escape out of my PowerPoint and jump over here to the internet. And if you go to my blog, I just have a little sidebar link that says Global Voices. You can click on it right there. Got a reminder, I'm supposed to be doing a presentation at Region 11. Okay, and here is the website. You do a little magnification. Okay, Global Voices. The world is talking. Are you listening? There's a conversation going on out here. And what is this project? Well, as I move my mouse over these countries, Bangladesh, 231 entries. Czech Republic, 12 entries. Saudi Arabia, 77 entries. Kazakhstan, 71 entries. You find France. Click on France, and I'm going to zoom back out. We've got some things on here about bold flavors of the world. I'm interested in the youth protests that have been going on in France. Okay, I've heard what the media has said about that. What are other people saying about it? Students killed in France. Members of Paris's African community have been rioting in the streets of Paris for the past 9 days. The riots were triggered by the death of two youths of African descent who were electrocuted at an electricity substation. This is real. This is really going on. And guess what? Ted Turner didn't approve this version of the news to be posted. There are hundreds of young people, primarily all over the world, who are blogging about their lives, their nation, the issues that they care about. Think about a mountain and a mountain stream. Mountain stream starts high in the mountains as a little trickle. As the snow melts high, the glacier, the ice and snow that never melts, or doesn't completely melt, it starts small. And what does it do as it goes downhill? It joins other streams. It joins tributaries. It becomes a stream. It becomes a river. You can think of this Global Voices as a funnel for a lot of voices that are talking about things they care about. And you have the opportunity not to just be swept away in the river, but to very quickly go all the way back up to that mountain stream, to where that voice in Sri Lanka, or that voice in Kazakhstan, or that voice in China has just talked about what's happening in their part of the world. Okay? Global Voices. And folks, this isn't a one-way transmission of content. This is a conversation. So when we go to one of these entries, we don't just have the opportunity to read it. We also have the opportunity to comment about it. And so we go down here and read, zoom in, criticism. Thanks for the info. I follow it from Brussels. Best. Here's somebody else saying, this is not a balanced account. It is just another politically correct denial of reality. This is about Islam and terror. This is about a religion that cannot live, blah, blah, blah. We've got a community of voices that are talking about these issues. And what I'm going to talk to you next about, to add to this idea of conversation, is this idea of complexity. Do we live in a complex world? Are the issues which we face and which we hear about on the news complex? Generally. Absolutely. And I think a lot of kids are pretty excited about complexity. They're motivated by it. And we can invite them to be in a conversation about issues that really matter and which often are very complex and usually have more than one side to them. Okay? Let me give you 2 minutes to turn to somebody beside you and just share a response about some of the stuff we've talked about so far. Go. You have 2 minutes. Let's get a few responses. Anybody want to share a takeaway, a thought, a response, a critique? Miguel.
This is just too real. We can't allow this in our schools. I mean, Global Voices, they're having real conversations. Did you read that comment about the Muslims and all that?
Somebody might be offended by that.
I don't know. If I were talking to someone who was gay, then I would probably block that site.
Maybe it is. I don't know. Do you know if it's is Global Voices blocked in your district?
Yeah.
Might be. It might be. Is that a conversation we should have with people in our community?
I like to show hands how many districts block.
Okay, show of hands. How many of you know that your district blocks like Blogger, blogs, MySpace? Yeah, everything. It's all blocked. It's a reactionary response. We have a very traditional institution that's called public schools. And it's typically easier to have a reactionary response, which is ban that, stop that, we ain't doing that here, rather than have a conversation about, whoa, do you know what's going on? Do you know why these kids were protesting about immigration policy? By the way, where did your grandmother and great-grandfather come from? They were born here? Oh, they were immigrants. Oh, should we talk about that? Some conversations we should be having. Okay, other responses. Yes, ma'am.
The danger for me is that anybody can write anything, and kids are going to tend to believe the first thing they read. And our challenge then is we have to teach them basically what we're having to teach our kids is you can't trust anything. They're going to lose all trust because they're going to have to evaluate. My question is, can we get them to read the article and then all the responses, so that they get the whole story rather than just taking in the first thing that they...
Even before blogging took off, research on students and their search strategies showed whether they were using Google or Yahoo, they tended to never go beyond the first page of search results. This is why you all know about Stormfront and MartinLutherKing.org. Raise your hand if you know about that. Okay, that's not half. Okay, you need to know about this. You are absolutely right. In terms of our challenge is challenging students to get multiple sources. You know, do I think we're going to... Okay, I'm at Google. This is not a trick, okay? Martin Luther King. This is good. It used to be the third hit. Oh. But do you think it would probably come up, though? Oh, okay. Yeah. Huh. So do I want to turn my safe search off and do that in front of all these people? There's a recipe for embarrassment. Okay, I am. I'll turn off my filter results and I'll remember that I did that. This used to be... And I have to do the search again? Well, I'm glad that it doesn't come up as number three, because it for quite a while it did. I actually had folks email me and say, please don't link to martinlutherking.org, because the more times you link to it, the higher it is on the Google ranks. So we're probably not going to see this. Oh, we do. MartinLutherKing.org, a true historical examination? I don't think so. If you go down here, you used to have to see that it said webmaster at Stormfront, but now at the bottom, they're proud. Okay, click on hosted by Stormfront. I do have a screenshot of that to bring up in other presentations, but it's white pride worldwide. It's a white supremacist group that is putting out disinformation. So your point is an excellent one. Do ultimately we end up depressed and not believing anybody because truth is relative and, oh, there is no truth? You know, the textbook has always been written from a particular perspective. There have always been voices not included and not represented in the textbook version. We tend to think of that as the pure, correct version. But there are so many voices that were excluded that, you know, it's actually a much more realistic approach, I think, to say, who said that? And who were they? And did anybody else say that? And did anybody else disagree with that? And again, embrace complexity. That's my next point. Let's get a couple more responses and then we'll... Yes, well, yes, ma'am. And then we'll come to you. You had one too. Banners. A banner, right? It's a banner. I mean, I was in Manhattan, Kansas, spring break with my family, met a gentleman named Mike Ribble. Mike is at Kansas State in the College of Education. Just finished his dissertation, creating a handbook on digital citizenship. If you go Google digital citizenship, Kansas State, you will bring up his page. ISTE, the International Society for Technology Education, is publishing his handbook in the fall. And his contention is, we've talked about citizenship in schools forever. I live in my community. I live in my state. I live in my nation. I live on my planet. And if I'm going to be a citizen of this globe, then I need to know some things, and I might behave. I have some responsibilities in that environment. Some people would say, including me, I have some rights. They're called human rights. And that's an important thing for us to be educating people about. Because I don't care whether you live in China or whether you live here in Texas, you are still a human being. And you're still, I think, a citizen of this globe, and there are rights and responsibilities that you have as a part of this community, whether that's a small community or a big one. But that isn't really part of our conversation in citizenship in schools today. MySpace is here, and it's not going away, but that's only a small piece of this broader conversation that we need to have. Okay, let's get another response. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
Way back when the internet first started, I can remember being in a class in Lubbock, Texas, with Bryce. And the very first time that we were doing the internet, and didn't know, you know, much of anything. Typed in toys, you know, that classic thing that comes back. We have now developed safety nets for some of that, and that's what's going to have to happen to me within the education community, is the safety net for our schools to go further.
Were you there when that, when something very inappropriate went up on the screen because he typed it in? And yeah, I tell that story to folks as an example of why we should bookmark things when we are presenting in front of people. Okay? Yes, sir. Couple thoughts. Number one, I'm not endorsing Hillary Clinton for the presidency with this comment, but I do believe it takes a village. Okay? She wrote a book by that title a while back. It cannot just be that one teacher who's trying to do that. The IT department needs to be with them. The superintendent and the whole administrative team need to be with them, because we want to be relevant and we want to provide the education that students need. If we just leave it up to the kids, are they going to just figure it out? Well, the technology, yes. But the ethics, the appropriate use, some of them will, but not all of them. Okay? Yes?
I think that same conflict comes into the case, whether it's drug education or sex education or any of those other things that have been the primary responsibility of the household. The problem is, you know, we didn't have too many households that are not doing those things, and we cross those. It's the same boundaries we've already crossed with drug education and with sex education and gang education and, you know, violence and all of those things that we covered that are sort of outside the comfort zone. And it has to be sort of handled in the same way, in a respectful dialogue between community members. And
if your district is not doing sex education, as mine, Lubbock ISD, is not, has not, I would not encourage teachers to, after school, offer a little session for parents and kids on sex ed, okay? But I will say that in this conversation about digital citizenship and internet safety, checking with your administrator and working with your administration, please do talk about these subjects at the PTA meeting. At presentations, have a chance to talk about not just the fear, not just the bad, but also the good. It's challenging. Okay, we'll get one more.
I'm just speaking as a voice of IT department. If the integrity of the network isn't, you won't have a voice for anybody. And there's so many people, you know, when you get on a global community, there are so many people that can destroy the integrity of that network. Now you don't have a voice for anybody. So you say administration, if you get upset when the IT people go, look, there's just too many things out there that can destroy this network, then we won't be able to get information out to anybody.
I'm not saying everyone should download LimeWire, Kazaa, peer-to-peer, you know, and go to town with bandwidth-consuming file sharing.
Just the links.
Yeah. That's why I think every school district in the nation, in the state, needs fiber. Because I'm telling you, the bandwidth requirements to support the global conversation that is only just beginning are exponential. That's why we need fiber. I mean, but, and I'm not fully, I mean, this conversation needs to happen. There is an IT perspective on this that is quite different from mine. And I may be wrong. I am wrong about a lot of different things. But I don't think I'm wrong in asserting that students are going to be engaged in these kinds of social networking activities and dialogues on their own time, on their own network connections, and that, like the gentleman here said, it's a choice of relevance. Are we going to choose to ignore it, or are we going to choose to deal with it in some way? Does that mean we're going to do district blogging? Maybe not. But at a very basic point, it should mean we're talking about not only the dangers and the bad side, but also the potential of that to get kids to write. Because I'm here to get kids excited about literacy and to get them excited about writing and communicating and to be part of that dialogue. Because if I can provide that kind of a tool to my child or to your child, I think of the Old West and, you know, the gun, the old 44, you know, that was the tool that won the West. Well, what's going to win the 21st century? Folks, it's a laptop, you know, it's a cell phone. It's the ability to reach out and communicate and talk to people and to do it in appropriate ways and to do it together. And so this conversation needs to happen. I'm not adequately probably responding, but let me go ahead. One of the things I'd suggest for you all, we've got a lot of folks involved in professional development. One of the best things that I just experienced 2 weeks ago in Florida was at the SITE conference, the Society for Information Technology and Teacher Education. They had a conversation after every keynote. So people who had a takeaway, had a thought, went to a room with the presenter, and they just sat around and talked. And it was just Q&A. I think that was great. Every conference I go to, I would like to see a follow-up conversation with the keynote speaker that gives us a chance to do this kind of thing. Because this is really valuable. But we need to do a little bit more. Nobody said this, but is anybody a math teacher? Okay. I didn't hear this, but you know, hey, I teach math, okay? I can't do blogs. Well, let me introduce you to Darren Kropotwa. He's in Manitoba, Canada. His website, one of them, is apcalc.blogspot.com. This is a screenshot of his blog from last night, from Sunday, April 2nd, where one of his students is blogging. I have had a lot of bad experiences with math. And I bet I am not alone in this room. One of the reasons why I think I had bad experiences was because some, not all, but some of my math teachers rarely, if ever, asked me to talk about what I understood. What do I know? What am I unclear about? So Darren is using this with his high school students in pre-calc and calculus to talk about their learning. Conversations. We need to engage students in conversations to ask them what they know, what do they understand, and what are they unclear about. Okay? Door number 2 is about conversation. Now these next 2 doors we're going to have to go forward a little bit more quickly. We got 15 minutes left. But I want to talk about complexity and then messy assessment. Let me suggest that kids want to embrace complexity. Why do I say this? Well, does anyone like Star Wars here? I will date myself. I was 7 years old in 1977 when George Lucas released Star Wars, and I wanted to be Luke Skywalker. And at that time, collecting Star Wars cards was so cool. That's what we did. Okay? But have you heard of this new LucasArts game called Empire at War? Have you read some of the descriptions of some of these? Okay, Here's the description. The war for the Star Wars galaxy is at your command. Choose your side. Plan your mission. Prepare your forces. Are you ready for total control? Will you repeat Star Wars history? Or will you change it forever? This game, unlike some online games and just computer-based games, has a real-time element that I haven't played it yet, but from what I understand, you can't pause it. It keeps going. And so there's this need for you to be making decisions and accessing information to deciding what you're going to do. A presentation I saw 2 weeks ago at FETC by a gentleman who has done research for the Lucas Foundation and others talks about how kids are used to now being in control of their information. But they come to school and what do they find? Out of control. I do not have control. And guess what? It's presented to me in a very simple form. Mark Prensky quotes a student who talks about saying he powers down when he comes to school. We don't want kids to power down when they come to school. If you look at gaming, I mean, we're not talking about Pac-Man here, folks. This is not Space Invaders. This is not an arcade. I'm done in 5 minutes, or maybe 15 or 20 if I'm playing really good and I get to level 20. Okay? We're talking about days and days to do highly complex immersive environments. Now, I definitely have some issues with a lot of things going on with games. You notice I'm not showing you a picture of San Andreas. What am I thinking of?
Grand Theft Auto,
San Andreas. Haven't played that one? Guess what? We won't be buying that at my house. Okay? I mean, you may have that. You may love that. That may be your favorite game. I bet it's the favorite game of some of your kids. I'm not going there today. I do want to make the point, though, that gaming ain't what it used to be. And the complexity that gaming offers to students and the control that it gives them over information is something they're doing on their own. I would contend schools tend to teach complexity in general rather poorly. Do you know why schools started in England? To control information. Information on the loose. Read Neil Postman's book, Technopoly. It's a little old. Postman's deceased. But Postman talks about how schools came to be. All these books, all this information, we got to control it. We got to make sure they read the right stuff and don't read the wrong stuff. So we have always tried, I think, to simplify and limit content. And just like you said, there's a need for structure. You know, we don't want chaos in our classroom. It needs to be structured. But in general, I don't think we tend to embrace complexity. Let me recommend a podcast to you. Again, this whole session will be available as a podcast, and I will have in what's called the show notes, which are just links, all the links to the things I talked about, Empire of War, Global Voices. I'll have a direct link to this website. So the only website you really need today is speedofcreativity.org. You can get to all of this from that. But this is a podcast from last November at the University of British Columbia by Carl Wieman, a 2001 Physics Nobel Prize winner. And the title of this presentation was Science Education in the 21st Century, Using the Tools of Science to Teach Science. Now, it's over an hour long. But here's a quick takeaway from that. Physics teachers at the university level use something called the force motion inventory. And in every entry-level physics class, you learn about laws of motion, formulas, you know, momentum, all this stuff. The research shows that kids have very little retention a year later, in general, because teachers don't tend to ask them to be in conversations with each other. Wieman, one of the things he advocates is if you're lecturing, stop every once in a while, ask the students to talk to each other, and get them to commit to an answer on some kind of a question. He calls them consensus groups. There's a lot of lessons we can get from this. One is that traditional transmission-based education that does not include a conversation doesn't work very well. Works for some learners, but it doesn't work for everybody. And another lesson from this, I think, is the fact that if you ask students to do the formula in the same way the textbook asked, yeah, they can usually do that. But if you, for instance, take a circuit and you say, what if instead of having the circuit this way, I change this and add power here, what will the light bulb do? I don't know. A question that really turns it around and really goes for comprehension and understanding reveals a very shallow comprehension. Because kids have content dipped, they have learned content to pass the test, but they haven't really learned the physics. So we have implications from this. I would recommend everybody, certainly in your science area, listen to that podcast. I mean, come on, this guy is a Nobel Prize winner in physics. He knows what he's talking about with science, and he's done the research about kids and learning. And he's saying we need to change. That has implications for conversation, complexity, and authentic assessment. And let's talk about problem solving briefly. I mentioned this before. We have well-structured and we have ill-structured problems. And you are familiar with both of these. Let's talk about trains. The train leaves Lubbock, Texas at 11 o'clock p.m. Another train going the opposite direction leaves Fort Worth, heading for Lubbock. If the speed of train A is blah, 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 and train B is blah, 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 when do they pass? That's a well-structured problem. You may or may not care about that problem. You may have just had a nightmare and a flashback when I bring that up because you were scarred as a child by the train problem. Okay? And I am sorry if I have just resurrected those horrible memories for you. Counselors will be available outside the door and we will be able to... Here's my point. Real-world problem solving... typically not well structured. Here's a real world problem for your child. Anybody had a child who's gone through this problem solving scenario? Where do I go to college? Is there only one answer? Absolutely. No, there's not. There's not. There's a lot of answers. In fact, I wonder if my own children shouldn't want to go to community college where they could know their professor better and be engaged in conversations with people of multi ages and life experiences. I don't know. There's not one answer. It's a complex question. Well, how about this question? How can I survive another day with my family? And I'm not kidding about this. Okay? Do you know about Darfur and the ongoing genocide in the Sudan? Do you know that when we talk about Holocaust prevention, we're not just talking about history? We're talking about right now. We're talking about families that have their government actually bulldozing their living area, their areas. There's this group called the Janjaweed. I don't know if you are an ER fan. ER a few weeks ago talked about Darfur. The Janjaweed go in and are allowed to rape, pillage, plunder, and kill. And in advance of that, the military helicopters of the Sudan will strafe the area with weapons made for killing people. This is happening now. I haven't read Michael Savage Inequalities, but I know you don't have to go to Africa to find people who are struggling to survive and who wonder how they are going to make it to school the next day. They live in our country. Quick example of avian bird flu. Is this a problem? Have you heard about this? How many of you have Google Earth? Do you know it's free? Do you know it's cross-platform? Okay. Just do a quick Google search for Google Earth avian bird flu, okay, and you'll pull up this article from Nature, warnings of a flu pandemic. And let's jump over to Google Earth really quick. It runs the same on a Mac as it does on Windows. I downloaded what's called a KML file, and so here we are in Google Earth, and we can do all kinds of things. We can, zoom in and look at a lot of stuff. It's cool. But let me go here to avian bird flu. Cumulative human cases. We might be looking at data normally in this form. This is tabular form. Okay, looking at cases and deaths and where they're located. But for free, you can download a map of the poultry outbreaks of avian bird flu. Let's fly there now on Google Earth. Okay, the map is red. Was this year? Okay, January through April 2006, going back to 2003. Okay, Let's go ahead and zoom in here a little bit. Let's step this back. Let's look at 2003 and the spread of this. That was 2003. There's 2004, January through April. There's mid-2004, end of 2004, beginning of 2005, mid-2005, September, December 2005. Here's January, April. Whoa! What just happened here? Whoa. Now, these are poultry outbreaks, okay? These aren't human deaths. We're talking about birds. But, oh my gosh, look at Europe. Okay, quick, spin over. Western Hemisphere. All right. Do I care what happens in Europe, by the way? Do I have a conception of being a global citizen? Should this matter to me? Okay, let's turn that off. And let's do the same thing. Let's zoom out a little bit. Remember, this is a free tool. This is just exploding. Okay, total human cases. Okay, you can see, whoa, there's some over there. These are human deaths. Okay, looks like southern China, north of Vietnam. More in Southeast Asia. Okay, end of 2004, beginning of 2005, mid-2005, end of 2005. But watch what happens when I click January, April 2006. Whoa, what happened here? Where do I live? Well, I live in Texas right now. But you know, I actually had an opportunity to travel to Turkey in 1986 when I was in high school. There's been a case of an avian bird flu death in Ankara. Well, how far is Ankara away from Istanbul, where some people I met live? It's 217 miles, or 350 kilometers. And where's it going to be tomorrow? What the heck is avian bird flu? How is it transmitted? What is a virus? Why do antibiotics not kill viruses? They kill viruses, don't they? No. How many other diseases jump animal to human? All these questions, all this complexity. Folks, we have got to encourage kids in school to embrace complexity, to ask questions that matter, and to use digital tools like this to explore answers to questions that would not have been possible previously. Check out Google Earth. It's amazing. Last thing I'll show you. Live airplane tracking. Okay, we're going to totally switch gears here. Let's look at all the live flights right now inbound into LAX. Let's fly there right now. This is live data. Okay, we're going to fly across the Pacific Ocean. This is a live track. These are 5-minute delayed images. There is every aircraft in the air right now. I'm thinking Homeland Security. Who has got access to this? Guess what? The world. Look at this. Okay, let's zoom in. Let's get granular here. Let's really zoom in. Look at all this. When I was in Houston a couple weeks ago, we had a thunderstorm and they shut down the airport. I mean, they stopped people from taking off. This is why we, took 2 hours to. This is why it took 2 hours for us to land. Okay. I mean, this is even cooler. Okay, this guy, oh wow, he's at 100 feet. Let's go there. He's at 164 knots. Now, I bet that's a private plane. Google Earth, unlike the web version, has terrain and three dimensions. Oh, it's United Airlines. Let's go ahead and tilt. And I could download a 3D version of this if I wanted. And I can actually look at vectors of aircraft coming in here. There's all kinds of stuff I could do with this. Okay? Miami. Let's go to Miami. Inbound aircraft, live. Everybody flying to Miami International Airport right now from the world. I just blogged about this last night. Within a very short amount of time, with a GPS on your cell phone, you will be able to, someone else will be able to track your location on the planet 24/7. Your cell phone will send a GPS ping to a server. It will be integrated into what's called a KML or a KMZ file, which is what we have here, that downloads a dynamic feed. Scary?
Yeah.
But potentially powerful? Absolutely. All right. I should ask you to respond to that, but you know what? I'm about out of time. If you go to my website, I've got a post about that, links to the files that I found, social bookmark sites where the reporter for Nature Magazine has accumulated all of those kind of things. I have my own now Google Earth social bookmarks where I've bookmarked these kind of things. We ought to do a workshop just on Google Earth. Okay? We could do that. We need to be doing complex things all the time. Okay? Not just after the tax test.
That's what learning would
do. Yeah, there's the learning. There's a dissertation someone's doing right now, I think at the University of Virginia, and it's like it's called the last something something, but it's like after the state assessment, then the fun learning can begin. Then the real learning. Guys, we got to do it all year round. Okay? We can't pack that in a month and a half or a month. Your teachers need to ask students to design things instead of just give them facts. Read Dan Pink's book, A Whole New Mind. Pink talks about the skills we're going to need for the 21st century. He answers Friedman. What do we need to do? Well, we need to have kids who are creative, who think out of the box, who can synthesize, who can play, and who can feed their mind and come up with the inventions that nobody has been able to, you know, begin to design yet. Door number two is about conversation and complexity and messy assessment. This is going to be really fast. But let me just say, we like clean assessment today in 2006 in a lot of schools. Our policymakers like it because it's easy, because it fits with a factory mode of education. It works with tables and charts that we like to put in our newspapers so our legislators can pat themselves on the back. Look at all the great stuff I'm doing for education because the bar graph's going up. Well, guess what? My kid's in that school. And we don't have recess in third grade and beyond because we have more important things to do. We're moving, by the way. That's not just the reason. I'm getting another job. But my kindergartner who went to school had a parent call back and said, "We heard you're moving. They don't have recess in third grade." It's more than that. But I'm upset about that, and you should be too. Last week when I was in Florida, I heard a gentleman from Holland talk about their country. Only 50% of the assessment of educational quality is based on the national assessment. The other 50% is locally defined. I don't think we can get rid of assessment. I don't want to, actually, because I'm a teacher. I assess all the time. If I'm not assessing you, I'm not teaching you. Because I don't know where you're coming from. I'm just talking at you. So we're not going to... I don't want to get rid of assessment. What I do want us to do is embrace messy assessment at least for 50% of the measure. Okay? Messy assessment. It's performance-based. Kids give speeches. Kids do things they can't fake. All right? If you're subscribed to TurnItIn.com and you're just... you know, wringing your hands because, golly, all these kids are just copying all this stuff off of the web and they're just plagiarizing it. Why don't you have them sit down and have a little conversation or a tutorial about that book that they were supposed to read with you and have the kids do something else? Why don't you do something authentic that they cannot fake? Digital storytelling can be used in that context. We've got to ask kids and teachers what they want to do. How would you like to represent your learning and knowledge on this project today? Do you want to write a 5-paragraph essay? Okay. Would you like to make a digital story? Would you like to make a podcast? Would you like to have a debate? Would you like to act out something? Whoa, that's messy. How do I put that on a bar graph? I don't know, but that's probably the school where I want my kids to go, and you do too. So my last example is kindergarten podcast. Okay? This is my daughter. I'm just going to play a little bit of this. Science Fair, Murphy Elementary, Lubbock, Texas. This is real. This is this year. Okay? She's talking about her project. She took the digital pictures of her quilt. This is kindergarten. Okay? We don't do hypothesis experiment, the null hypothesis. You know, we don't go there. We have a woodland animal that we research, and we have a way of representing our learning about this. And so Sarah talked to me about her learning.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I just wanted to tell you about my science project that I did about hedgehogs. How babies are born. Mommy hedgehogs lay a nest of eggs for their babies. Mommy's have 5 or 6 babies. When their babies...
Now, we're not going to have time to see this whole thing. This is on the web, and I'll link it. You can see it if you want to and download it. Let's go to where she talks about the sad facts. By the way, notice that you're not seeing her. Notice that you're not having an email address or a MySpace account, which she does not have because she's 5. You cannot virtually reach out and touch my daughter but through me. Same thing about these safe blogging techniques we're talking about. You can't reach out and touch the kid through the school website. If they have their own MySpace account, that's a different deal. This is the last thing I'll play.
I think it's really sad when the babies have to leave home when they're about 4 or 6 weeks old.
Why is that sad?
Because they can't see their mommy anymore. They have to take care of themselves.
That's hard to imagine doing when you're that little, isn't it?
All right, so she didn't fake that, guys. And we need our teachers and students doing assignments they cannot fake. A funny story about this is my 2-year-old, after we did this, wanted to talk to everyone who came to our house about hedgehogs because somehow talking about hedgehogs was a significant event and a significant thing. And if you could talk about hedgehogs, you were very intellectually in demand, you know. In the Friar home. So, authentic assessment. This was not fake. A conversation took place, and you can see it. Reflective thinking took place. Your third administrative takeaway, your administrative challenge, is that you require, in your school district, messy assessment. It is not optional. When I come into your room and I'm the principal of your school, I expect to not just see clean assessment and bubble sheets throughout the year. Are we going to do bubble sheets? Unfortunately, we are. Okay? I had to take the GRE again, you know, to get back into graduate school. But I'm so glad my university didn't just make me data, didn't just look at that. They looked at other things. We've got to do the same thing with our kids. Okay? We're not going to have time for the final activity. This is going to be your lunch assignment. But here's what I'll conclude with. Have you heard the NPR series, I Believe? This, I Believe. Okay, NPR has all their stuff pretty much on podcast now, so you can download it, listen to it on your mobile device, wherever you happen to go. You all have commutes, I think, here. I have a 7-minute drive in Lubbock. This morning was my appreciation of the Metroplex and going back to West Texas. So I just wrote a little piece that I submitted to NPR of this I Believe. People write all kinds of things. My piece was, I believe in teachers, and I believe in you. I believe in our country. I believe that we can have an educational system that is more about conversation, complexity, and messy assessment than it is just about students passing a test and getting the graph and the bar chart to be looking like we want it to in the newspaper. You are the gatekeeper of change in your sphere. That may be a small sphere, your classroom, but it is a vital sphere. It is an important sphere. Those kids that you touch depend on you every day. You may be the superintendent. You may be the principal. The point is, you are the gatekeeper. And I apologize that this is a little bit off the screen, but let me read you these last two thoughts about digital curriculum. And this is something I wrote. What will ultimately define us and the schools we lead in the 21st century is not the digital curriculum all around us, but our responses to the opportunities which that digital curriculum affords. Will you choose to get by in an ocean of mediocrity, or will you stand up and lead on an island of excellence? The latter choice is door number 2, and my challenge to you today is to open the door for yourself and all the educational constituents that are in your charge. Open the door. and have a great day.